This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of December 11th, here are a few top stories. In the news, the Phoenix City Council is talking about the arena again. Here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein and Christina Estes.
After months of silence, we're hearing snippets about negotiations between the City of Phoenix and the Suns. Phoenix contends state law allows them to keep details about arena options confidential during the negotiation process. But council members are complaining they're being kept in the dark. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes has been following the issue and joins me now. Christina, you were at yesterday's council meeting where there were some members expressing frustration with this process.
Yes, Councilwoman Kate Gallego, who's running for mayor, led the charge. In a nutshell, she asked, "Where's the report?" Then several other council members jumped in. It's been 10 months since the council approved a $75,000 contract for a consultant to study arena options. Then yesterday they approved another $125,000.
And what's this consultant supposed to be studying?
Well, let's go back to February, because that's when the council hired the consultant, Barrett Sports Group, to study a range of options for the city-owned arena where the Suns play. The to-do list was supposed to include what it would cost to renovate or build a new arena for basketball, and then also what it would cost to renovate or build new for basketball and hockey, presumably for the Coyotes, who've expressed interest in leaving Glendale.
But this whole arena review stems from the Suns owner Robert Sarver saying the team needs a better place to play.
Yes, the Suns have a potential out in their lease agreement with the city. There's something called, bear with me in case I screw this up, an obsolescence clause that kicks in about 5 years. Basically, it says if the building's obsolete, the team can leave.
I'll brave this as well. So since obsolescence clause is a legal phrase, that means the definition is open to debate.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say it's open to negotiation. Most people think of obsolete as being out of date or no longer useful. But that could mean one thing to a team playing in a 25-year-old facility and something else to a mayoral candidate like Kate Gallego. Here she is asking staff to provide details from the consultant.
When this item first went forward, we were told they would come up with a list of costs for the arena. For example, how much we would need to have a good functioning plumbing system, which seemed like a reasonable cost to me, and then other costs, which I, for one, would not prioritize in these difficult budget times, such as spending a lot of money upgrading suites, luxury suites. And so I had asked to get a list of the work product and have not been able to see that yet.
Councilman Sal DeCiccio quickly backed her up, saying it's a reasonable request, and others joined in. Assistant City Manager Milton Dahoney Jr. told the council they've identified some things that need to be done now, like plumbing issues, but
there are other things, however, that have been identified as clearly needed in terms of infrastructure. But we have not taken steps to begin actions on those because it was pointed out to us those would better be addressed within the realm of a renovation if one was going to occur.
So what he's saying is we know there are things that need upgraded or fixed, but we really don't want to start messing around until we know whether we're doing a big renovation, and if so, who's going to pay for what. While no specific dollar amount has been floated for renovations, most people around City Hall use the phrase hundreds of millions of dollars.
And has the consultant ruled out anything? As we've heard, maybe the hockey team would come there as well.
Well, that's what Councilman Jim Waring wanted to know. Listen to this exchange between Waring and City Manager Ed Zuercher.
Are we doing the hockey or not? Because that was much discussed. Haven't heard much about it recently.
Mayor, Councilman Waring, that the whole question of hockey is actually part of the negotiations with the Suns. So I don't want to get into that at this point.
We know Councilman Jim Waring is against spending public money on sports facilities. Who else have you talked to?
I've reached out to all council members at least twice, maybe three times since October, to get their take on using tax revenue from hotel stays and car rentals to either pay for arena upgrades or to build a new one. Kate Gallego has been the only one to join Waring in the absolutely not, no way camp. Two others, Councilwoman Deb Stark and Councilman Sal DeCiccio, are open to renovations if it's what they consider a good deal for taxpayers, with the team splitting the cost. In an email last month, Councilman Daniel Valenzuela, who's also running for mayor, said, quote, "The practice of placing the undue financial burden on sports venues on our taxpayers needs to end." Then during yesterday's meeting, he voted to spend more on the consultant's study, saying it's an important issue and Phoenix needs to continue to maximize efforts at the city-owned facility. And finally, I should say I've received no responses from Vice Mayor Laura Pastor and council members Thelda Williams and Michael Nowakowski.
Anyone in the definitely yes camp?
Well, no one's saying yes because they're still waiting to see a list with all the costs. While Mayor Greg Stanton is arguably the Suns' biggest cheerleader, he repeated his pitch that the arena is about more than basketball games.
That building is currently busy over 200 nights per year, and obviously it supports many businesses. Many people are employed inside and outside of that arena as a result of how busy it is.
I've been trying to verify that number, that over 200 nights per year, because I've heard it a lot. I asked Phoenix to provide a calendar of arena events, and they directed me to the Suns because the team actually operates the arena. I explained to the Suns that the city uses this over 200 phrase, and I'd like to know how they came up with it. After three requests over a two-month period, I'm still waiting.
Well, so what are the next steps now with the council and negotiations?
The city manager told council members they will get an update, including a list of immediate needs and costs, when they meet in executive session next month.
Executive session means behind closed doors, right?
Yes. So what they discuss is considered confidential while they are negotiating. But based on the passionate comments at yesterday's meeting, I expect we will hear details as soon as a decision to make a deal with the Suns or not is reached.
KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Estes, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
From KJZZ's original production, The Show, here is host Steve Goldstein.
Cecil B. DeMille's 1956 version of The Ten Commandments featured Charlton Heston as Moses, fighting against the oppressiveness of Ramses II, played by Yul Brynner.
Let my people go!
Slaves are mine. Their lives are mine. All that they own is mine. I do not know your God.
But DeMille directed a different incarnation of the Ten Commandments, a silent version, 3 decades earlier. And recently, archaeologists in Southern California found a sphinx used in that 1923 film. It was from the set that was buried there by DeMille, at least in part because it was too difficult to move. Scott Iman is DeMille's biographer and is with me to explain more about why the set was buried and why DeMille made two different Ten Commandments films. Scott, what was DeMille thinking when he decided to hide the set? He basically buried it.
Well, it was perfectly logical at the time. He needed a flat space with a great deal of sand because Egypt is flat and it has lots of sand. Paramount Pictures, which is where he was working, had a very small back lot. It was out of question to build the set size he wanted to build on the back lot. All the studios had ranches out in the valley they used for lavish sets that they didn't have room for in Hollywood because space in Hollywood is limited. But the Paramount Ranch was rolling. It was all rolling and it was all green, and there was no way they could convert it all into ancient Egypt. So he needed a flat space with a lot of sand, and he found Guadalupe, which is nothing but sand. And it's a long drive from Hollywood, but it was exactly what he needed, and it's close to the ocean. So he could use it to also film the Exodus. He built his set at Guadalupe, a huge set with rows of sphinxes leading into the walled city of the Pharaoh. He shot the footage he needed, and then he had the problem of, what do I do with this? Now, his core problem was it was public land. It was not owned by Paramount. It wasn't owned by anybody. He simply took over the land to build the set and had guards there at night to make sure nobody was taking pictures. But when the production left Guadalupe, he was worried about have somebody coming in and bootlegging the set and shooting some quick and dirty movie and getting that wonderful set that he'd paid serious money for out to the public before he could get his film out to the public. So, not surprisingly, he decided to level it. He tore down the huge walls that he'd built, but the sphinxes, which were made out of plaster on bases, he simply kind of bulldozed over on their sides and covered them with sand, and there they lay for the next 90 years.
I mean, DeMille is one of the kings of Hollywood, certainly, in the history of Hollywood filmmaking. How did this set compare? Was this set something that was so incredibly unique? Did it just blow people away at the time?
Yes. In the late... the first huge set that was built in Hollywood was D.W. Griffith's set for Intolerance, the Babylon set, and that's 1916. And then came World War I, which kind of involved a lot of men and material, so not a lot was done in 1917, 1918. After World War I, Hollywood began competing with each other in building splendid sets. This was climaxed by Douglas Fairbanks building a huge Norman castle for his film of Robin Hood in 1922. And DeMille was essentially just raising the ante and building an even bigger set, you know, for ancient Egypt in 1923. That was about the ultimate. That was as far as they went, because Adolf Zucker, who was one of the co-founders of Paramount, along with DeMille, was convinced DeMille was going to destroy the company because he simply didn't care about money, according to Zucker. And the set and the production of the Ten Commandments was so expensive that he began maneuvering to get DeMille out of the company because he thought DeMille's primary allegiance was to DeMille and not to Paramount.
So clearly, the 1950s version of the Ten Commandments is quite a different film. So how satisfied was he with the two films, as different as they were?
He was very proud of both of them for different reasons. He was proud of the first one because it was he was laying his marker down as a maker of an epic spectacular, which became his dominant mode of production. It's what he was known for then. It's what he's known for now. And I remember John Carradine once told me he enjoyed DeMille. He liked him a lot. A lot of actors didn't like him. But Carradine liked him. He said, because on his last day working on the Ten Commandments, DeMille came up to him and said, John, your great-grandchildren will see you in this picture 100 years from now. And Carradine said, and it looks like he was right.
What do you think DeMille would have made of all the CGI stuff, considering he loved to have these big sets?
Well, he was a man of the theater, and he liked sets. He liked physical things. All the filmmakers of that era did. They wouldn't have understood the attraction of working exclusively with green screens or blue screens, although DeMille had to do that a lot when he shot the Red Sea parting. That was all done with the rough equivalent of blue screens today. But I'm sure he would have adopted it, you know, because he was very interested in technical things, even though his heart, his dialogue is always firmly in the 19th century. If you look at his films, they're very modern in terms of the era in which they were made.
Was the epic what we would call the blockbuster of today, Scott? And the fact that most of the blockbusters today are based on superheroes, or there was the Harry Potter run for a long time. What do you think, as someone who's been a film historian, about how the nature of an epic has changed, and how much of that, again, is because of computers and green screens and that sort of thing?
When you look at a movie made in a DeMille picture, for instance, there's a real sense of physicality. You can feel the weight of the buildings. You can feel you can see 5,000 extras in a shot, you know, because there really are 5,000 extras in a shot. When you see a modern picture like that, Ridley Scott did a dreadful Exodus picture called, I think it was, Of Gods and Kings. And, of course, he had, you know, where DeMille had 6,000 people in the Exodus in one shot, Ridley Scott had 20,000 people, but they were all little bouncing dots. You know, they were zeros and ones. They were all digital people. They weren't really people. And you could feel the difference in the emotional impact of the filmmaking. Photography doesn't lie. It does lie, but it doesn't lie because it translates emotions and it translates the spiritual impact of what DeMille is photographing.
Scott Eyman is a film writer. One of his books is Empire of Dreams, The Epic Life of Cecil B. DeMille.
This is KJZZ's Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In business news, water, they say, is for fighting over. And a recent land deal in northwest Arizona is yet another example of that. KJZZ's Brett Jaspers reports on a plan to buy property to get a hold of its water.
Dennis Rule works at the agency that runs the Central Arizona Project. The CAP brings Colorado River water to the Metro Phoenix area. It also replenishes groundwater in the valley. Rule, however, grew up in Tennessee, where flooding is a big concern. Walking the halls of the CAP's offices, he recalls a conversation he had with a hometown friend.
Telling him about how we have fights over effluent, sewage. And he was just flabbergasted. It's like, you fight over sewage? And I said, yes, it's an important water supply.
Almost every drop in Arizona is an important water supply and can lead to fights. And there's one going on right now. Dennis Rule and the CAP are trying to buy farmland in between Bullhead City and Lake Havasu City. They want its Colorado River water rights. They'd fallow some of the land and use that irrigation water to replenish groundwater in central Arizona. The purchase is getting major pushback from residents.
The whole reason the Phoenix area and Tucson area wants the water is so that they can grow. Okay, so why steal it from us and hinder our growth just so they can grow?
Karen Summit is a real estate agent in Mojave Valley.
I've been here since the 70s, and I've seen this place start to grow and then stall out, and it's wonderful to see it start growing back.
Summit thinks a potential home builder might want that water allocation. If it's committed to Phoenix, for example, it can't be used for homes in Mojave Valley. John Pineker runs the Bullhead Area Chamber of Commerce. He says when bigger employers shop around for a location, they look for employee housing.
As these businesses continue to grow and get staffed and we add new businesses, those people aren't going to have houses. And depending on the business, they won't be able to get a water allocation either.
So the Mojave Valley wants the water for the same reason Central Arizona wants it, for development. The CAP's Dennis Rule.
There is a lot of discussion and a legitimate issue of, you know, connecting land use planning and water supply. But I would say that that is a broader discussion.
And Rule, as a water manager, can't wait for the broader discussion. He needs agreements like these. Why? Well, if Phoenix developers plan to use groundwater for new homes in Arizona, they have to enroll in CAP's groundwater replenishment program. It's meant to maintain the level of the aquifer. As the program grows, the CAP has to find more and more water for replenishment. State law mandates it.
We need to develop additional reliable water supplies for our existing obligation.
In this case, it's getting a new water supply by making a private land purchase. The CAP is buying the farmland from a hedge fund company, about 2,200 acres, for $34 million. There's a local board that has a role here, the Mojave Valley Irrigation and Drainage District. It can allow water to leave the area or not. The board has 5 members, all large landowners or representatives of large landowners. One member works for the seller of the farmland in this deal. He's recused himself. The board declined requests for an interview. John Pineker of the Bullhead Area Chamber of Commerce doesn't see why his area's water should be shipped off to satisfy demand elsewhere.
If I lived in Wisconsin and me and my neighbors wanted a mountain by us, we couldn't go and hire somebody to move a mountain to us. I don't understand the whole why you have to provide them with water. You know, move to where the water is.
The water war continues next month when the Irrigation Board meets again. If it allows the water transfer, the state would review the deal, then make a recommendation to federal regulators. Brett Jaspers, KJZZ News.
In science news, here's Steve Goldstein from KJZZ's The Show.
A 3-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has handed a victory to environmental groups over a uranium mining ban on lands next to the Grand Canyon. The National Mining Association and related groups had asked the court to overturn the 20-year moratorium that was put in place in 2012 by then-Interior Secretary Ken Salazar. Kevin Dahl, Arizona Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association, joins me with his perspectives on the ruling and what could be next. Kevin, you're obviously pleased with the ruling, but what were your biggest worries about the ban possibly being lifted?
Drilling for uranium near the Grand Canyon happens in a very complicated, complex aquifer. The underground water there is not well known, and we're afraid that it's contaminated by these uranium mines. The water supplies the unique seep springs and side canyons of the Grand Canyon, and it also supplies the only water source for the Havasupai Indians who live at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. So we're concerned that this is the wrong place to mine for uranium until a lot more is known about the underground aquifer, and that's why the moratorium was put in place, so that we can find out what sort of impacts it might have. It's a precautionary measure, very important, not only to the Grand Canyon's water supplies, but, you know, that drains into the Colorado River, which supplies 40 million people, you know, L.A., Las Vegas, Phoenix. It's real important that area, this most iconic landscape, the sacred landscape, be protected forever.
And when you mention iconic, this becomes less a legal question for me and more a philosophical one. So many people from around the world visit the Grand Canyon. Almost everyone knows what the Grand Canyon is. Does that play in a part, obviously not in the Ninth Circuit ruling, just in terms of its importance? This is such an iconic place in America that the idea of uranium mining gives a lot of people a stomachache, even those who are not involved in the environment on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think so. And when this issue is put to the test, when people are polled, should we have uranium mines near the Grand Canyon? Republicans, Democrats, Independents, almost everybody says no. Now, that's the purpose of my organization. You think national parks like Grand Canyon are perfectly protected, but they're not. The people have ideas to do things near them or in them that are inappropriate. You know, there's not a whole lot of national parks. There's 59 of them in the country, and they deserve the most important protection. We shouldn't be uranium mining near them. We shouldn't be fracking for oil or gas near them. Yet that's what's happening on public lands near our national parks.
Kevin, let's talk about the congressional hearing that was held, which also involved Arizona Representative Paul Gosar. It's the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Energy and Mineral Resources. It seemed that they attacked the ruling when they had an opportunity to. What did you make of the hearing, and what did you hear from it? What was your perception?
Well, the hearing was held as part of the Trump administration's program to remove burdens from public lands in the production of energy and other resources. This subcommittee was looking at other mineral withdrawals, but the uranium one at the Grand Canyon is one of them. So, yeah, Representative Paul Gosar thinks we should mine uranium there. Congressman Raul Grijalva, who's the ranking member, the minority member, also from Arizona, strongly believes that we shouldn't. So it received an hearing. The lobbyist for the American Mining Association thinks that we should mine near the Grand Canyon. However, there was a tribal council member from Havasupai who gave a very eloquent presentation about her homeland, how the water is so important to them, and that the land and the water should not be polluted.
There is the perception, and this is obviously on one side of the political aisle, that the Ninth Circuit is too progressive, too liberal. That's been going on for a very long time. Does that indicate anything to you about where the next step is? I presume the opponents of the Ninth Circuit ruling are going to try to take this up to the highest court, to the Supreme Court. Any concerns about that?
The mining companies who have the right to appeal this to the Supreme Court, we suspect they won't, because the ruling is pretty clear. The district court was very clear. They're consistent between the circuit and the district court. It doesn't seem that they have much basis for appeal. And despite political leanings, one hopes that the courts are fair. But our lawyers are pretty sure that they won't. Our bigger concern is that the Trump administration or Congress will decide to attack this moratorium. And we really hope that they don't. The moratorium is to collect more information. Let's collect more information, and down the road we can revisit this decision. That seems like the most reasonable thing to do at this time.
Kevin Dahl is Arizona Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk, here's Matthew Casey.
A state committee on border security has decided to empty out its coffers. The last of the cash in the Border Security Trust Fund will go to the Cochise County Sheriff's Office. Financed by private donations, state lawmakers set up the fund in 2011. The Cochise County Sheriff's Office received $219,000 in 2015 and used the cash to grow a surveillance program that uses cell service to send pictures of smugglers within minutes of being taken. Now it will get about $55,000 more for the program. Cochise County Sheriff Mark Daniels says the cameras see places other technology can't.
That's a literal statement where we're down in the weeds, where we know they're smuggling, down in the areas where the normal traditional cameras can't see them, can't detect them, where we can.
With all of the fund's money gone, the Border Security Committee also voted to ask the legislature to dissolve it. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from the Education Desk, here is a look at the latest efforts to recruit teachers.
Vail is about 25 miles southeast of Tucson. It's a rural area, think wide open spaces. The Vail School District encompasses 425 square miles.
Last spring, district officials sat down to brainstorm how they were going to fill more than 100 empty teaching positions. Attracting enough teachers is a constant struggle for the district.
John Carruth is associate superintendent with the Vail School District.
And one of the barriers for us in recruitment and retention is that there is no affordable housing within our school district. Of that 425 square miles, for example, there are no apartment complexes.
That means young teachers might opt to live in a more affordable place outside Vail and commute in.
When someone floated the idea of tiny homes for teachers, there were chuckles, but then there was talk that maybe that wasn't such a bad idea.
And the district recently purchased about 14 acres of land. Part of that comprises the original town site of Vail. It is within walking distance to three of our schools. It is walking distance to a grocery store that will open in February. And it's walking distance to a few restaurants in the area.
The tiny idea grew into a master plan for 24 homes.
Rent would go back to the district, and Carruth says the living expenses will be the same or even cheaper than living in an apartment outside Vail.
He says this isn't meant to be in place of bigger solutions like higher teacher pay, but with salary packages, they don't have as much wiggle room to get creative.
We're trying to do something that we, within the bounds of what we have control over in this market and in the environment with which we live in Arizona, and our staff are already paying for housing somewhere. And what we're really trying to do is provide them a highly attractive, high-quality option that might be smaller, but that's located here.
They're still looking at different funding options outside of the regular budget, but Carruth says they haven't found a blueprint to turn to.
We have not been able to find examples of somebody who's already done this. There was another school district, interestingly, outside of Vail, Colorado, that was also looking to do something similar, but to my understanding, they haven't.
They plan to have four tiny homes ready to go by next summer for any teachers ready to downsize to roughly 250 square feet.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.